Part 3, Chapter 11. Chamri roused up quickly when I sat down on his bunk. I told him I wanted to stay with him a while, as there'd been a misunderstanding at Barna's house. "What do you mean?" he said. He got the story out of me, though I didn't want to say much. "That girl, she was in your room?" "Oh, by the stone! You get clear out, clear away, tonight." I argued. It had merely been a misunderstanding. Barna had been drunk. But Chamri was out of bed, rummaging under the bunk. "Where's that stuff you left, your fishing gear and all?" "There. Knew it was here. All right. Take this stuff of yours and go to the gate. Tell the watch that you want to be at the trout pool before sunrise. It's the best fishing just at sunrise."
"The best fishing's at sunset," I said.
He looked at me with pained disgust. Then his look sharpened. He touched my cheek.
"Got a whack, did you? Lucky he didn't kill you right there. If he sees you again, he will. He turns on men like that, over women. Or somebody trying to shake his power. I've seen it.
Saw him kill a man. Strangled him and broke his neck with his bare hands. You take this stuff. Here's your old blanket. Take it, too. Go to the gate."
I stood there, blank as a post.
"Oh, I'll go with you," he said crossly, and he did walk me hastily and by the back streets towards the city gate, talking with me all the way, telling me what to say to the watchman and what to do when I was in the woods. "Don't go by the paths. Don't take any path. They're all guarded one time or another. I wish..." "Yes, that's it. He can take you. Come on, this way." He changed course, turning off on the street where Vene lived with his raiding group. He left me standing in the black shadow of the barrack and went in. I stood there, looking at the silver-blue roofs, which danced a little to the throbbing in my head. Chamri came out again with Vene.
"It's hunting you're going," he said, "not fishing. Come on."
Vene was carrying a couple of bows and had his quiver on his back.
"Sorry you're in trouble, Gav," he said mildly.
I tried to explain that I wasn't in trouble. Barna had just been drunk, and all this panic was unnecessary. Chamri said, "Don't listen to him. Got his brains knocked loose. Just take him to where he can get clear away."
"I can do that," Vene said, "if they'll let us out the gate."
"Leave that to me," said Chamri. And indeed, he talked us out the city gate with no trouble. Chatting with the guards, he made sure at once that Barna hadn't sent out anybody after me. The guards knew all of us and let us go with nothing but a warning to be back by sunset.
"Oh, I'll be back in no time," said Chamri. "I don't set out on hunting trips at midnight. I'm just seeing these idiots off."
He went with us till we were past the gardens and at the forest's edge.
"What'll I tell them when I come back?" Vene asked.
"You lost him, at the river. Looked for him all day. He fell in, or maybe he ran off."
"Think it'll do?"
Vene nodded.
"It's thin," Chamri said judiciously. "Pretty thin. But I'll say I'd heard Gav talking about running off to ASEAN. So he tricked you into taking him out hunting, and then gave you the slip. You'll be all right."
Vene nodded again, unworried. Chamri turned to me.
"Gav," he said, "you've been nothing but a burden and trouble to me ever since you turned up and tried to wear my kilt on your head. You dragged me back here, and now you're running out on me. Well, have a good run. Go west."
He looked for confirmation to Vene, who nodded.
"And stay out of the uplands," Chamri said. He put his arms around me in a hard embrace, turned away, and was gone in the darkness under the trees. Unwillingly, I followed Vene, who set off without hesitation on a path I could scarcely make out at all. The flashes of moonlight through the branches and trunks of the trees dazzled and bewildered me. I kept stumbling. Vene realized that I was having trouble and slowed down.
"Fetched you a whack, eh?" he said. "Dizzy?"
I was a little dizzy, but I said it would wear off and went on. I was still sure that everybody had gone into a foolish panic, urging me into running away from a mere misunderstanding that could all be explained in the morning. I'd seen Barna in a rage before. His anger was mindless, brutal while it lasted, but it didn't last. It blew over like a thunderstorm. I planned that at dawn, I'd tell Vena I was turning around and going back. But as we went on at an easy pace in the cool night air and silence, my head gradually cleared. What had happened in Barna's house began to come back to me. I began to see it again. I saw Barna fondling the motionless, expressionless girl while men and women watched. I saw the terror in Irad's face when she ran to us to hide from him, and the madness in his face. I saw the dark red bruise on Diero's cheek. Vene halted on the rocky steep bank of a small stream to drink. I washed my face. My right ear and both cheeks were sore and swollen. A little owl wailed away off in the woods. The moon had just set. "Let's wait here till there's a bit of light," Vene said in his low voice, and we sat there in silence. He dozed. I wet my hand and laid the cool of it against my swollen ear and temples again and again. I looked into the darkness. I can't say how my mind moved in that darkness, but as the trees and their leaves and the rocks of the stream bank and the movement of the water began mysteriously to take on being in the gray, dim beginning of the light, I knew, with a certainty beyond decision, that I could not go back to Barna's house. The only emotion I felt was shame. For him, for myself. Again I had trusted, and again I had betrayed, and been betrayed. Vene sat up and rubbed his eyes. "I'll go on," I said. "You don't have to come farther." "Well," he said, "my story is you gave me the slip, so I've got to spend all day pretending to look for you. And I want to get you on far enough they won't catch you. They won't be looking for me." "Can't be sure of that. Barna won't want me back. He might want to finish knocking your brains out." Vene stood up and stretched. I looked up at him with a melancholy fondness. The slender, scarred, soft-voiced hunter who had always been a kind companion. I wished I could be certain that he wouldn't get into trouble with Barna for abetting my escape. "I'll go on west," I said. "You circle round and come back from the north, so if they do send out after me, you can send them off the wrong way. Go on now, so you have time to do that." He insisted on coming with me till he could get me on a path that would take me out of the Danaran forest to the west road. "I've seen you going in circles in the woods," he said. And he gave me many instructions. Not to light a fire till I was clear out of the woods. To remember that at this time of year, the sun set well south of west. And so on. He fretted that I had no food with me. As we went along, on no path at all, but through fairly open oak woods, he kept looking at every hump and hillock in the ground, and eventually pounced on a heap of brush and trashwood, tore it open, and laid bare a wood rat's granary, a couple of handfuls of little wild walnuts and acorns.
"Acorns will give you the pip, but better than nothing," he said. "And over by the west road, there's a big stand of sweet chestnuts. You might find some still on the trees. Keep an eye out. Once you're out of the forest, you'll have to beg or steal. But you've done that before, eh?"
We came at last to the path he was looking for, a clear wood road that curved right off to the west. There, I insisted that he turn back. It was late morning already. I was going to shake his hand, but he embraced me, hard, as Chamri had done. He muttered, "Luck go with you, Gav. I won't forget you. Or your stories. Luck go with you." He turned away, and in a moment was gone among the shadows of the trees. That was a bleak moment. At this time yesterday, I'd been at the food handout in Barna's house with a cheerful group of men and women, looking forward to reciting for Barna in the evening. Barna's scholar. Barna's pet. I sat down on the edge of the wood road and took stock of what I had. Shoes, trousers, shirt, and coat. The old ragged, evil-smelling brown wool blanket, my fishing gear, a pocket full of nuts stolen from a wood rat, a good knife, and Caspero's Cosmologies. And all my life in Archimond, and in the forest, every book I had read, every person I had known, every mistake I'd made, I brought that with me this time. "I will not run away from it," I said to myself, "never again. It comes with me, all of it." And where should I take it? The only answer I had was the road I was on. It would lead me to the marshes, to where Sallow and I had been born, to the only people in the world I might belong to. "I'll bring you back your stolen children, or one of them anyway," I said in my mind to the people of the marshes, trying to be jaunty and resolute. I got up and set out walking west. When I went up the riverbank away from Etra, I was a boy dressed in white mourning, going alone, a strange sight in itself, and people could tell that I was not in my right mind. That had protected me. The mad are holy. Now, walking along this lonely forest road, I was 2 years older and looked and dressed like what I was, a runaway. If I met people, my only protection from suspicion or from slave takers was in my own wits and from Luck, who might be getting tired of looking after me. The road would bring me out on the west side of the Danaran forest, and going on west or southwest, I'd come to the marshes. I didn't know what villages might be on my way. I was sure there were no towns of any size. I had seen the country where I now was, from far off, long ago, in the golden evening light from the summit of the Ventine Hills. It had looked very empty. I remembered the great blurred shadow of the forest eastward and the level, open land stretching north. Sallow and I had gazed for a long time. Sotor asked us if we could remember the marshes, and I spoke of my memory of the water and the reeds and the blue hill far off, but Sallow said we'd both been too young to remember anything. So that memory must be the other kind I used to have, a memory of what had not happened yet. It had been a long time since I had such a vision. When I left Etra, I left my past behind me, and with it, the future. For a long time I'd lived in the moment only, until this past winter, with Diero, when I finally had the courage to look back, and take back again the gift and burden of all I'd lost. But the other, the visions and glimpses of time to come, it seemed I'd lost forever. Maybe it was living among the trees, I thought, as I walked along the forest road. The infinite trunks and tangling, shadowing branches of the forest kept the eye from seeing far ahead in space or in time. Out in the open, in the level lands between the blue water and blue sky, maybe I'd be able to look forward again, to see far. Hadn't Sallow told me long ago, sitting close beside me on the schoolroom bench, that that was a power I had from our people? "Don't talk about it," says her small, soft voice, warm in my ear. "Gavir, listen, truly. You mustn't talk about it to anybody." And I never had. Not among our captors, our masters in Archimonde, who had no such powers, who feared them and wouldn't understand. Not among the escaped slaves in the forest, for there I'd had no visions of the future, only Barna's dreams and plans of revolution and liberation. But if I could go among my own people, a free people, without masters or slaves, maybe I'd find others with such powers, and they could teach me how to bring back those visions and learn the use of them. Such thoughts buoyed my spirits. I was, in fact, glad to be alone again at last. It seemed to me now that all the year I was with Barna, his great, jovial voice had filled my head, controlling my thoughts, ruling my judgment. The power of his being was in itself like a spell, leaving me only corners of my own being, where I hid in shadow. Now, as I walked away from him, my mind could range freely back over all the time in the heart of the forest and with Brigand's band, and before that, with Kugra, the old mad hermit who had saved the mad boy from death by starvation. But that thought brought me sharply back to the present moment. I hadn't eaten since last night. My stomach was beginning to call for dinner, and a pocketful of walnuts wasn't going to take me far. I decided I wouldn't eat any until I reached the end of the forest. There, I'd have a wood rat banquet and decide what to do next. It was still only mid-afternoon when the road came out through a thin strand of alders to meet another, larger road that ran north and south. There were cart ruts on it left from the last rains, many sheep tracks, and some horseshoe tracks, though it lay empty as far as I could see. Across it was open country, scrubby and nondescript, with a few stands of trees. I sat down behind a screen of bushes and solemnly cracked and ate 10 of my walnuts. That left me 22 and 9 acorns, which I kept only as a last resort. I got up, faced left, and walked boldly down the road. My mind was busy with what I might tell any carter or drover or horseman who overtook me. I decided the one thing I had that might show me as something more than a runaway slave boy was the little book I carried in my pouch. I was a scholar's slave, sent from Ascyon to carry this book to a scholar in Etra who was ill and wished to read it before he died, and had begged his friend in Ascyon to send it to him, with a boy who could read it to him, for his eyes were failing. I worked on the story diligently for miles. I was so lost in it, I didn't even see the farm cart that turned from a sidetrack into the road a little way behind me until the jingle of harness and the clop-clop of big hoofs woke me up. The horse's enormous, mild-eyed face was practically looking over my shoulder. "Haup," said the driver, a squat man with a wide face, looking me over with no expression at all on his face. I mumbled some kind of greeting. "Hop up," the man said more distinctly. Good ways yet to the crossroads.
I scrambled up onto the seat. He studied me some more. His eyes were remarkably small, like seeds in his big loaf of a face.
You'll be going to Shecha, he said, as an inarguable fact.
I agreed with him. It seemed the best thing to do.
Don't see you folk much on the road no more, the driver said.
And at that, I realized that he had taken me for, that he had recognized me as one of the marsh people. I didn't need my complicated story. I wasn't a runaway, but a native. It was just as well. This fellow might not have known what a book was. All the slow miles to the crossroads, through the late afternoon and the immense gold and purple sunset, he told me a tale about a farmer and his uncle and some hogs and a piece of land beside Ratwater and an injustice that had been done. I never understood any of it, but I could nod and grunt at the right moments, which was what he wanted.
Always like talking with you folk, he said when he dropped me off at the crossroads. Keep your counsel, you do. There's Shecha Road.
I thanked him and set off into the dusk. The side road led off southwest. If Shecha was a place of the marsh people, I might as well go there. After a while, I stopped and cracked all the rest of the walnuts between two stones and ate them one by one as I went on, for my hunger had grown painful. Evening was darkening when I saw a glimmer of lights ahead. As I came closer, the shining of water reflected the last light in the sky. I came through a cow pasture to a tiny village on the shore of a lake. The houses were built up on stilts, and some stood right out over the water at the end of piers. There were boats docked, which I couldn't make out clearly. I was very tired and very hungry, and the yellow glimmer of a lighted window was beautiful in the late dusk. I went to that house, climbed the wooden stairs to the narrow porch, and looked in the open door. It seemed to be an inn or beer house, windowless, with a low counter but no furniture at all. Four or five men sat on a rug on the floor with clay cups in their hands. They all looked at me and then looked away so as not to stare.
Well, come in, boy, one said.
They were dark-skinned, slight, short men, all of them. A woman behind the counter turned around and I saw old Gammy, the piercing, bright, dark eyes, the eagle nose.
Where do you come from? She said.
The forest. My voice came out as a hoarse whisper. Nobody said anything. I'm looking for my people.
Who are they, then? The woman asked. Come in.
I came in, looking hangdog, no doubt. She slapped something on a plate and shoved it across the counter towards me.
I don't have any money, I said.
Eat it, she said crossly.
I took the plate and sat down with it on a seat by the unlighted hearth. It was a kind of cold fish fritter, I think. Quite a large one, but it was gone before I knew what it was.
Who's your people, then?
I don't know.
Makes it a bit hard to find them,
one of the men suggested. They kept looking at me, not with a steady stare or with hostility, but covertly studying the new thing that had come their way. The instant disappearance of the fritter had caused some silent amusement.
Around here?
Another man asked, rubbing his bald head.
I don't know. We were stolen. My sister and I. Slave raiders from Etra. South of here, maybe.
When was that?
The innkeeper asked in her sharp voice. 14 or 15 years ago.
He's a runaway slave, is he?
The oldest of the men murmured to the one next to him, uneasy.
So he was a little tad,
said the innkeeper, filling a clay cup with something and bringing it to me.
What name had you?
Gavir. My sister was Sallow.
No more than that?
I shook my head.
How'd you chance to be in the forest?
The bald man asked, mildly enough, but it was a hard question, and he knew it. I hesitated a little and said, I was lost. To my surprise, they accepted that as an answer, at least for the moment. I drank the cup of milk the woman had given me. It tasted sweet as honey.
What other names do you remember?
The woman asked. I shook my head. I was 1 or 2 years old.
And your sister?
She was a year or two older.
And she's a slave in Etra?
She pronounced it Etra. She's dead. I looked around at them, the dark, alert faces. They killed her, I said. That's why I ran away.
Ah. Ah, said the bald man. Ah, well.
And how long ago was that?
2 years ago. He nodded, exchanging glances with a couple of the others.
Here, give the boys something better than cow piss, be ya?
Said the oldest man, who had a toothless grin and looked a little simple.
I'll stand him a beer.
Milk's what he needs, said the innkeeper, pouring my cup full again. If that was beer, he'd be flat on his face.
Thank you, Ma'io, I said, and drank the milk down gratefully. The honorific, I think, made her give a rasp of a laugh.
City tongue. But you're a Rossiu,
she observed.
So they're not on your trail, so far as you know,
the bald man asked. Your city masters. Down there. I think they think I drowned, I said. He nodded.
My weariness, the food filling my hunger, their wary kindness and cautious acceptance of me as what I was, and maybe my having to say that Sallow had been killed, it all worked on me to bring tears into my eyes. I stared at the ashes in the hearth as if a fire was burning there, trying to hide my weakness.
Looks like a southerner,
one of the men murmured, and another, I knew a Sallow Evo Donaha, down at Crane Levels.
Gavir and Sallow are Sidoyu names, the bald man said. I'm off to bed, Bia. I'll set off before dawn. Pack us up a dinner, eh? Come along south with me if you like, Gavir.
The woman sent me upstairs after him, to the common sleeping room of the inn. I lay down in my old blanket on a cot and fell asleep like a rock dropping into black water. The bald man shook me awake in the dark.
Coming?
He said, and I struggled up and got my gear and followed him. I had no idea where he was going, or why, or how, only that he was going south, and his invitation was my guidance. A tiny oil lamp burned in the room downstairs. The innkeeper, who stood behind the counter as if she had stood there all night long, handed him a large packet wrapped in something like oiled silk.
took his quarter bronze and said,
"Go with me, Almeida."
"With me," he said. I followed him out into the dark and down to the waterside. He went to a boat, which looked immense to me, tied up to a pier. He untied the rope and dropped down into the boat as casually as stepping down a stair. I clambered in more cautiously, but in a hurry, as it was already drifting from the pier. I crouched in the back end of the boat, and he came and went past me, doing mysterious things in the dark. The gold spark of the inn doorway was already far behind us over the black water, and fainter than the reflections of the stars. He had raised a sail on the short mast in the middle of the boat, not much of a sail, but it took the slight wind, and we moved steadily on. I began to get used to the strange sensation of walking while floating, and by the time there was some light in the sky, I could move around well enough, if I hung on to things. The boat was narrow and quite long, decked with a low rope rail all around. The whole middle of it was a long, low house. "Do you live on the boat?" I asked Almeida, who had sat down in the stern by the tiller and was gazing off over the water at the growing light in the east. He nodded and said something like, "Oh." After a while, he remarked, "You fish?" "I have some gear."
"Saw that. Give it a try."
I was glad to be of use. I got out my hooks and lines and the light pole that Chamri had taught me how to make in fitted sections. Almeida offered no bait, and I had nothing but my acorns. I stuck the wormiest one on the barb of a hook, feeling foolish, and sat with my legs over the side, trailing the line. To my surprise, I got a bite within a minute and pulled up a handsome reddish fish. Almeida gutted, split, and boned the fish with a wicked, delicate knife, sprinkled something from his pouch on it, and offered me half. I'd never eaten raw fish, but ate it without hesitation. It was delicate and sweet, and the spice he'd put on it was ground horseradish. The hot taste took me back to the forest a year ago, digging horseradish roots with Chamri Bairn. My other acorns wouldn't stay on the hook. Almeida had kept the fish guts on a leaf of what looked like paper. He gave them to me as bait. I caught two more of the reddish fish, and we ate them the same way.
"They eat their kind," he said. "Like men."
"Looks like they'll eat anything," I said. "Like me." Always when I'm hungry, I crave the grain porridge of Archimonde, thick and nutty, seasoned with oil and dried olives, and I did then. But I was feeling very much better with a pound or two of fish in my belly. The sun had come up and was warming my back deliciously. Small waves slipped by the side of the boat. Ahead of us and all around us was bright water, dotted here and there with low islands of reeds. I lay back on the deck and fell asleep. We sailed all that day, down the long lake. The next day, as its shores drew together, we entered a maze of channels between high reeds and rushes, lanes of blue-silver water, widening and narrowing between walls of pale green and dun, endlessly repeated, endlessly the same. I asked Almeida how he knew his way, and he said,
"The birds tell me."
Hundreds of small birds flitted about above the rushes. Ducks and geese flew overhead, and tall silver-gray herons and smaller white cranes stalked the margins of the reed islets. To some of these, Almeida spoke as if in salutation, saying the word or name, Hassa. He asked me no more about myself than he had the first night.
and he told me nothing about himself. He was not unfriendly, but he was deeply silent. The sun shone clear all day, the waning moon at night. I watched the summer stars, the stars I'd watched at the Vente farm, rise and slide across the vault of the dark. I fished, or sat in the sunlight and gazed at the ever-differing sameness of channels and reed beds, the blue water and the blue sky. Almeida steered the boat. I went into the house and found it almost filled with cargo, mostly stacks and bundles of large sheets of paper-like substance, some thin, some thick, but very tough. Almeida told me it was reed cloth, made from beaten reeds and used for everything from dishes and clothing to house walls. He carried it from the southern and western marshes, where it was made, to the other parts, where people would pay or barter for it. Barter had filled his house with oddments, pots and pans, sandals, some pretty woven belts and cloaks, clay jugs of oil, and a large supply of ground horseradish. I gathered that he used or traded these things as he pleased. He kept his money, quarter and half bronzes and a few silver bits, in a brass bowl in the corner of the structure, with no effort to conceal it. This, and the behavior of the people at the inn at Shecha, gave me an idea that the people of the marsh were singularly unsuspicious or unafraid, either of strangers or of one another. I knew all too well that I was prone to put too much trust in people. I wondered if the fault was inborn, a characteristic, like my dark skin and hawk nose. Over-trustful, I had let myself be betrayed, and so had betrayed others. Maybe I had come to the right place at last, among people like me, who would meet trust with trust. There was time for my mind to wander among such thoughts and hopes in the long days of sunlight on the water, and to think back, too. Whenever I thought of my year in the heart of the forest, I heard Barna's voice, his deep, resonant voice ringing out, talking and talking. And the silence of the marshes, the silence of my companion, were a blessing, a release. The last evening of my journey with Almeida, I'd fished all day and had a fine catch ready. He lighted and tended a fire of charcoal in a big ceramic pot with a grill over the top of it, set out on the deck in the lee of the house. Seeing me watching him, he said, "You know, I have no village." I had no idea what he meant or why he said it, and merely nodded, waiting for more. But he said no more. He spattered the fish with oil and a few grains of salt and broiled them. They were succulent. After we ate, he brought out a pottery jug and two tiny cups and poured us what he called rice grass wine, clear and very strong. We sat in the stern. The boat was moving slowly down a wide channel. He did nothing to catch the wind, but only touched the tiller now and then to keep the course. A clear blue-green-bronze dusk lay over the water and the reeds. We saw the evening star tremble like a drop of water low in the west. "The Sidoyu," Almeida said. "They live near the border. Slave takers come through there. Could be that's where you came from. Stay if you like. Look around. I'll be back through in a couple of months." After a pause, he added, "Been wanting a fisherman." I realized that he was saying in his laconic way that if I wanted to rejoin him then, I was welcome. Next morning at sunrise, we were again in open water. After an hour or two, we approached a solid shore where some trees grew,
and little stilted houses stood up over the banks. I heard children shouting. A small mob of them were on the pier to meet the boat.
"Women's village," Almeida said.
I saw that the adults following the children were all women. Dark, thin-limbed, in brief tunics, with short curling hair like Sallow's hair. And I saw Sallow's eyes. I saw her face, glimpses, flashes of her everywhere among them. It was strange, troubling, to see these strangers, these sisters, all about me. As soon as we tied up at the pier, the women were scrambling over the boat, peering at what Almeida had to offer, feeling the reed cloths, sniffing the oil jars, chattering away to him and to one another. They didn't speak to me, but a boy of 10 or so came up, stood in front of me with his feet apart, and said importantly, "Who are you, stranger?" I said with a rush of absurd hope of being instantly recognized, "My name is Gavir." The boy waited a moment, and then asked rather pompously, as if offended, "Gavir..." It seemed I needed more names than I had. "Your clan," the boy demanded. A woman came and pulled him away without ceremony. Almeida said to her and an older woman with her, "He was taken as a slave. Maybe from the Sidoyu." "Ah," the older woman said, turning sideways to me, not looking at me, but unmistakably speaking to me, she asked, "When were you taken?" "About 15 years ago," I said, the foolish hope rising in me again. She thought, shrugged, and said, "Not from here." "You don't know your clan?" "No, there were two of us, my sister Sallow and I." "Sallow is my name," the woman said in an indifferent voice. "Sallow is Sidhu Asa. I'm seeking my people, my name, Ma'io," I said. I saw the sidelong, flashing glance of her eye, though she stayed turned half from me. "Try Ferusi," she said. "The soldiers used to take people from down there." "How will I come to Ferusi?"
"Overland," Almeida said. "Walk south. You can swim the channels."
While I turned to get my gear together, he talked with Sallow Isidu Asa. He told me to wait for her while she went into the village. She came back with a reed cloth packet and laid it on the deck beside me.
"Food,"
she said, in the same indifferent tone, her face turned from me. I thanked her and stowed the packet in my old blanket, which I had washed out and dried on the journey through the marshes, and which served as a backpack. I turned to Almeida to thank him again, and he said,
"With May."
"With May," I said. I started to hop off the pier onto the ground, but a couple of women called out a sharp warning, and the officious boy came rushing to block my way. "Women's ground! Women's ground!" he shouted. I looked about, not knowing where to go. Almeida pointed me to the right, where I made out a path marked with stones and clamshells right at the edge of the water.
"Men go that way," he said.
So I went that way. Within a very short distance, the path led me to another village. I was uneasy about approaching it, but nobody shouted at me to keep away, and I went in among the little houses. An old man was sunning himself on the porch of his house, which seemed to be built of heavy reed-cloth mats hung on a wooden frame.
"With May, young fellow," he said.
I returned the greeting and asked him, "Is there a road from here, Badi?"
Badi, badi, what's badi? I am Rova Isidu Meni. Where do you come from with your badi, badi? I'm not your father. Who is your father?
He was more teasing than aggressive. I had the feeling he knew the salutation I had used perfectly well, but didn't want to admit it. His hair was white, and his face had a thousand wrinkles. I'm looking for my father, and my mother, and my name.
Ah, well, he looked me over. Why do you want to go south?
To find the Ferusi.
Ah, they're a queer lot. I wouldn't go there. Go there if you like. The path goes through the pasture.
And he settled back down, stretching his little black bony legs, like crane's legs, out in the sun. No one else seemed to be in the village. I could see fishing boats out on the water. I found the path leading inland through the pasture and set off south to find my people.